Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth.
Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. On this episode, we'll hear an interview with Jude Ortiz, an organizer with a summer 2010 caravan called the Conspiracy Tour in support of the RNC8 activists targeted for their community organizing at the 2008 Republican National Convention in the Twin Cities. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a selection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Latinos for Internet Freedom, a new coalition of more than 40 organizations and groups, launched last week to advocate for an open and accessible Internet. With 47 million people, Latinos are the largest community of color in the United States. Amalia Deloney of the Center for Media Justice says that the organizations who make up the coalition have come together to ensure that Latinos have a say in Internet policymaking.
They all have a deep commitment to being of service and working with Latino communities. And so they represent the voices of real Latinos in the community, not community members who are on the payroll of a telco, not high-powered lobbyists who are inside the Beltway. These are average folks that we grew up with, that we work with, that live in the neighborhoods that we come from, who work on issues that have a profound impact on the health and well-being of Latino communities. And all of these organizations are saying, in addition to all of the other things that we're engaged in, we absolutely want to say that we want an open Internet.
The key partners of Latinos for Internet Freedom are Presente and the Center for Media Justice.
We have organizations from New Mexico like Media Literacy Project and San Antonio Esperanza Peace and Justice Center and the Media Justice League, folks like People's Production House in New York, Main Street Project in Minnesota, organizations of all different sizes with a range of issues that they're committed to.
Deloney says that for Latinos, the Internet is mediating many aspects of life. The Internet has become the place to go for regulating immigration status, accessing health care information, finding after-school programs for kids or English language classes, and even searching for jobs.
All of those things, are important to Latinos and are a part of having an open Internet. But I think more crucial is the fact that it's the primary advocacy and organizing tool that we're using. You know, whether it's the pushback on SB 1070 in Arizona, whether it's the work that's done after immigration raids in communities, whether it's just the national advocacy we're doing on other issues like education and healthcare, like everybody else, we're using the Internet to connect to one another. We're using the Internet to connect and share stories with our families, wherever they may be. And we need to know that the experience that we have online is not discriminated against by our Internet service provider.
For more information, go to latinonetlibre.com.
Bloggers beware. A company in Las Vegas is scouring the Internet for copyright infringement and filing lawsuits against websites that host Las Vegas Review Journal articles. Righthaven has filed nearly 100 lawsuits against small bloggers, nonprofits, and political and community organizations for purportedly violating copyright law. The company has sued people for anything from sharing entire articles to linking to an attributed article to hosting a forum where readers include links to articles and comment sections. Cindy Cohn, legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, said her organization is troubled by what appears to be a, quote, lawsuit mill.
It appears that this is a business model, that they're just bringing a whole lot of copyright lawsuits and figuring that they can shake down enough money from enough people to make themselves a tidy profit.
Righthaven demands thousands of dollars and scares people into settling out of court, even if their cases could fall under fair use. Cohn said that Righthaven's sweep is particularly shocking because the company is not following the traditional protocol of simply notifying websites to take down questionable content.
They're basically suing people first. They're not You know, they're not sending any cease and desist notices. They're not giving any notice whatsoever. They're basically suing first and asking questions later. To me, it really reflects the fact that this is a business proposition for them and not really people who care about copyright infringement.
And the business proposition appears to be growing. Another newspaper chain in Arkansas, WEHCO Media, which controls 28 papers in the state, has become a Righthaven client. The practice has people wondering if newspapers will increasingly turn to small copyright lawsuits to bolster waning profits.
I understand that the powers that be in journalism are very concerned because their business model doesn't work very well in an era of Craigslist and classified ads for free. But, you know, the idea that suing the audience is the answer here, and in this instance, suing the small bloggers who are simply trying to draw attention to the work that you've done, you know, many of them, is going to save the journalism. I just don't think anybody who seriously thinks about the future of journalism thinks that this is the answer. I think that's what the lawyers are telling people in order to try to make it look like they're not doing what they're doing.
Cohn said that bloggers and websites should research fair use guidelines to help protect themselves and make sure they are reposting content properly. To find out more information, visit www.eff.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
This weekend saw two major black demonstrations, one in Washington, one in Detroit, and a presidential speech at Xavier University in New Orleans on the fifth anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Yet a small, hardly noticed protest outside what used to be a public housing project in the St. Bernard section of New Orleans was probably more relevant to the burning issues of today than the rallies held by Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. A relatively small group of New Orleans activists gathered in the rain outside the project to protest the visit to the city by President Obama, whose housing policies spell doom for the entire concept of public housing in the United States. When Katrina struck, the Bush administration's Department of Housing was quick to call for demolition of all the public housing units in New Orleans, even though most of the buildings were salvageable. The residents were locked out, 3,000 of them, like hundreds of thousands of others across the country since the early 90s, victims of corporate greed for the land the projects sit on, and a racist prejudice that holds that black and poor people are inherently dangerous when concentrated in one place. Katrina was simply a convenient excuse to get rid of public housing in New Orleans, where four major projects were demolished. In New Orleans and elsewhere across the country, the poor who are evicted from public housing are expected to disperse, get out of the way of corporate development that serves the needs of other people, and be quiet. But this weekend, the former residents of the St. Bernard Project refused to scatter and be silent. They had earlier built a tent encampment nearby called Survivors Village. Now they denounced President Obama and his friend Warren Buffett, the multi-billionaire hedge fund baron who's developing the site of their former homes under a new name, Columbia Park, for a new class of residents. The Obama administration has taken the anti-public housing policies of Bush and previous presidents to a new level, with a plan to abandon any federal commitment to building and maintaining housing for the poor. Instead, fat cats like Warren Buffett and huge private banking institutions will inherit the nation's public housing properties. In New York City, the Citigroup bankers now own a piece of 13 public housing projects, a taste of what Obama has in store for what remains of America's public housing stock. At the start of this commentary, I said that the St. Bernard neighborhood demonstration was probably more relevant to the burning issues of today than Al Sharpton's Washington rally and Jesse Jackson's Detroit event. That's because the demonstrators in New Orleans knew whose policies they were protesting against and called out his name, President Obama. in Detroit and Washington, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and trade union leaders denounced unemployment, home foreclosures, and war in general, but did not dare to hold the corporate Democrat in the White House responsible for any of it. Obama's wars ranged from Asia and Africa to the streets of America's cities, whose schools and housing he is turning over to the likes of Warren Buffett, rich finance capitalists that have already exported all the jobs. The demonstrators in New Orleans understand that. What currently passes for black leadership does not. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. We now feature an interview with Jude Ortiz, an organizer with a summer 2010 caravan called the Conspiracy Tour in support of the RNC 8 activists targeted for their community organizing at the 2008 Republican National Convention in the Twin Cities. The following interview was recorded on July 28, 2010. We are joined via Skype with Jude Ortiz. Jude Ortiz is an anarchist worker who has worked with the RNC8. We'll learn a little bit more about that in a moment, as well as an organizer with what's called the Conspiracy Tour 2010. And he is joining us on the phone from, I understand you're in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, Minnesota?
I'm actually in Chicago this evening.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Welcome
to Chicago and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So let's begin by first learning a little bit about, as we mentioned in your our introduction, the Conspiracy Tour. Tell us a little bit about what it is and why you're involved with it.
The Conspiracy Tour is a program that is going around the nation, a lot of places in the nation, for an entire month from July 25th through August 25th, and it's to raise support and awareness for the RNC8 and Scott the Youth, all of whom are organizers, like political organizers from the Twin Cities who are facing conspiracy charges as a result of their activism. I became involved with the Conspiracy Tour because I'm involved with both the RNC 8 Defense Committee and the Scott and Kerry Support Committee, which are groups from Minneapolis who are organizing to raise awareness and legal defense funds for these activists.
By helping to support their activism, what kind of activism are you referring to?
Well, the RNC8 were people who were associated with the RNC Welcoming Committee, and RNC standing for Republican National Convention, and that was the convention that happened in St. Paul, Minnesota back in 2008. And they were targeted through the course of year-long undercover investigations by both the local sheriff's department as well as the FBI, and they became targets because of their involvement and a dedication to helping organize protests against Republicans and their policies through the RNC Welcoming Committee, which was an explicitly anarchist and anti-authoritarian organizing body. They were initially charged with conspiracy to riot and the furtherance of terrorism. That charge was later dropped, but they are still facing two counts of conspiracy, one for conspiracy to riot and one for conspiracy to commit criminal damage to property, and they go to trial on October 25th. Scott DeMuth was involved in one of the house raids that happened prior to the RNC, and at which point some of his journals and his computer were taken, and those were later used as part of the basis for his indictment under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and he is currently facing a conspiracy under that law, which was passed in 2006, and he is going to trial in mid-September of this year.
These sound like very serious charges. Are there any grounds for these charges? I mean, if it seems like that the members of the RNC8 or these organizers were involved in serious crimes, what exactly were they doing that merited such criminal charges?
Well, supporters feel they weren't doing anything to merit these charges, and that these charges are entirely baseless and politically motivated because they are outspoken and highly effective anarchist organizers. What they were doing, the RNC8 were involved in the RNC Welcoming Committee, which is helping organize a convergence space for the protests where people could go for free meals and meetings and whatnot, as well as a blockading strategy for the convention in order to give people the opportunity to share their political messages and resistance to the Republican National Convention, the Republican Party itself, and the policies that the party promotes. And Scott DeMuth has been involved in a number of different projects in the Twin Cities, including a prisoner support work for people who have been targets of state repression through the Green Scare, which is a term that refers to the government's campaign against Earth and animal liberation activists. So what the government's really doing is looking at that political organizing, which should be constitutionally protected activity, and viewing that as a threat, and a threat warranting outrageous charges such as conspiracy and indictment under law such as an Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. So what we're really seeing is that these people are being targeted because of their political identification and association and because of their political work, and not because of any alleged criminal activity that the government can try to point to, like through the legal system.
I remember when in August and September of 2008, there was actually a press conference that actually recorded where Chicago political activists were announcing their solidarity and efforts to help out with not only Chicago activists who had ventured to the Twin Cities to engage in day-to-day on-the-ground solidarity work, but also to decry, and I actually did see reports about this, raids that apparently the police had done on what seemed like really spurious charges that these political activists were apparently trying to set up some kinds of homemade bombs. Therefore, all of them should have been raided, and actually a lot of them were. What are your thoughts about these kinds of raids and the kind of trumped up charges that had accrued from them?
The raids that happened prior to the RNC were highly targeted and designed to disrupt and destroy the organizing that was happening. And because of the strength of the organizing that was happening in the Twin Cities and elsewhere around the nation, like, those efforts were unsuccessful. But the cops were able to violate people's rights to a large degree. Like, through those raids, they raided both the convergence space where activists could go for free meals and meetings. And during that raid, the cops seized a lot of literature, which should be protected under the First Amendment as a form of free speech, and people's personal computers. And they even went so far as to strip search at least one person in the building, which was open to people who were coming to protest the convention. And then the next morning, the cops raided three houses in Minneapolis. And these cops were dressed in full SWAT gear with assault rifles and broke down doors and arrested people at gunpoint. And through those raids, they also seized additional literature and typical household items that you would expect to find in houses, such as bicycle inner tubes and different tools and buckets and different things like that. Things that you would typically find in garages, for example. And they called those instruments of for property destruction and rioting. So what the state was trying to do with those raids was not only to scare people away from any kind of political organizing, any kind of public dissent, but also to find things that are entirely legal to possess and entirely harmless to possess, and claim that those things were actually instruments of destruction and instruments of terror.
Have the police faced any kinds of repercussions for what basically amounted to a scare and smear campaign?
The police have faced a lot of political repercussions for the abuses that they clearly enacted during the RNC. And there have been some legal repercussions that are in the work through civil litigation, civil lawsuits against the police, for violating people's rights. But a thing to know about St. Paul, which will probably resonate a lot with people who live here in Chicago, is that the police department is extremely abusive and extremely corrupt. In fact, the sheriff of Ramsey County, where St. Paul resides, was involved, and some of his top officers were involved in a corruption probe right before the RNC. And the sheriff, Sheriff Bob Fletcher, was also part of the Metro Gang Strike Force, which was an extremely abusive and violent and corrupt multi-jurisdictional entity that was shut down because of involvement in stealing property and money and harassing and abusing people, like beating people up and that sort of thing.
But despite these various criminal probes, it seems like that the people who were in power, it sounds like, are still in power. Is that the case?
That is very much the case. Yes, the people who are in power and were in power during the RNC are very much like in control still. And so there's still a lot of really strong political organizing happening in the Twin Cities to resist and confront the abuses of power that we see like throughout our communities every day, particularly poor communities and communities of color in the Twin Cities. And with that, the RNC8 and Scott and Youth have been able to receive a lot of support from people from a variety of a population within the area, because we've been able to like form relationships that are stronger than the repression that the state can go out to us.
You're in Chicago right now, and it turns out that there was a presentation on the evening that we're recording, which is July 28th, that there was an event that's connected with the conspiracy tour in Chicago that was originally scheduled for DePaul Law School. But, well, I guess I should let you tell the story. Apparently something happened. What happened?
The conspiracy tour was scheduled to present at DePaul Law School this evening. And our presentation entails a musical puppet show, as well as audience interaction, like with the use of puppets, like throughout the presentation. And the presentation itself covers a historical overview of state repression that provides some context for conspiracy charges and the ways that they're used against political organizers, as well as more information about the RNC8 and about Scott the Youth and Carrie Feldman, who both Scott the Youth and Carrie Feldman were subpoenaed to a grand jury in Davenport, Iowa. And Carrie was held on civil contempt for 4 months before being released. And Scott was subsequently indicted under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And the point of the presentation is to raise awareness so that people understand the issues at play and the situations that these nine defendants are in, as well as to raise like, political support and legal defense funds for these defendants, because the legal fees will be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars total. Now, we're not entirely sure of how everything happened because a lot of this information is hard to verify, but from everything we understand, everything that we've been told, the Chicago Police Department contacted DePaul University and said that we had, you know, quote, come under the radar, end quote, and that we should be, like, quote-unquote, contained for the safety of the institution. The university initially let us know that they would be hiring security to be present during our event, and that the people who are organizing the event with us would be financially responsible for that security. And realizing but the repressive conditions that would create, both for us as people who are going and exercising like constitutional and protective rights to free speech and free association, and asking people to come out to an event to support people who are facing like severe state repression, like, we couldn't in good conscience like have an event under those conditions where there'd be security guards who we would have to pay for to create repressive conditions for us and people attending our presentation. So rejecting those conditions, we changed locations so that we could still have our event here in Chicago as we wanted to, but without participating in that ridiculous situation. After we had decided to move the event, DePaul backtracked a little bit and said that we wouldn't have to actually pay for our own repression, but we are still like adamantly against trying to raise political support, educate people about the way that police departments and other governmental entities abuse and repress people, as well as people's rights and ways that they can resist that kind of repression. We refuse to do that under repressive conditions, and therefore we change the event location.
this might be a little bit too early to ask, but have you figured out yet, or are you thinking of whatever, how you may want to respond back to what DePaul and the Chicago Police Department did?
We actually haven't had a chance to really focus too much on how to follow up with DePaul, other than to express our disappointment in their willingness to bow down to harassment from the police department. We don't know where, like, what is behind the police department harassing DePaul about, like, our event that was scheduled to happen on their campus. But we do know that when the RNC Welcoming Committee was conducting tours around the country prior to the RNC to raise support for people to come out to voice opposition to the Republican National Party and their policies, the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office paid an officer to go around the country to take photos of the Welcoming Committee members who were on those tours and doing presentations at, like, public venues. So having experienced and lived through this pattern of police repression and abuse of, like, you know, investigative powers, we think that there's a likelihood that the source of the Chicago Police Department's abuse and off-duty could go a lot deeper than the Chicago Police Department itself. So we haven't had a chance to really figure out how to approach DePaul and voice our dissatisfaction and disappointment in their decision. But we definitely want them to know that we think it's extremely sad and pathetic that a law school, which is supposed to be focused on defending and educating people about constitutional rights, would bow down so quickly to harassment by the police.
If I can turn the topic back a little bit more to the tour in question itself, the Conspiracy Tour 2010, it sounds like, is underway. But can you tell us a little bit about how it's been going, this harassment notwithstanding?
The Conspiracy Tour has been going really well so far. We are on our fourth stop out of about 27. And as I said, we are doing a whirlwind trip over the course of a month to raise support for these nine defendants. We have been receiving a tremendous amount of support from people all across the nation, from a variety of different parts of the movement for social justice overall. People have been helping us find locations for events. They've been helping us promote them. They've been offering us housing and food while we're there to help us get from one stop to the next. So there's been an outpouring of support and solidarity for us as we work to support these nine defendants as they face their politically motivated charges. We have a very ambitious program for the tour, both in the sense of the presentation that we do each night, as well as going 8,000 miles in a month in order to spread the word as much as we can and raise as much support and solidarity as possible. And we are looking forward to this. In a lot of ways, it's gone better than we expected, even with such high expectations to begin with. Another thing about the tour is that when you look at the situation that the RNC 8 and Scott DeMuth are in, where they were targeted for their political organizing, and the state has tried to call that organizing conspiracy, we decided to name the tour for the Conspiracy Tour and invite people to join the conspiracy. And the thought behind that is that if political organizing, if political associations and, like, relationships and activism, if the state is going to call that conspiracy, then we say join the conspiracy, join the resistance to the repression, and don't allow them to get away with chipping away at our abilities to associate freely and organize for a more just and safer and better world. We can't afford to back down and let them, like, take those freedoms away from us. We have to fight back. We have to join together and fight back. And that's why we're inviting everybody to join the conspiracy with us this summer.
And if you could talk a little bit about, to wrap things up, some of the more specific things that you would ask for people to get involved. What could people do? How could people, in what specific ways would you recommend people get involved? How can people learn more?
people can get involved in a variety of different ways. If we are going through their city, they can help promote the event and attend the event themselves and bring a whole bunch of like their friends and family out. If we aren't able to visit their cities, they can arrange for caravans or carpools to come out to our events, or even if they're not able to travel at all, they can raise awareness within their own communities about the RNCA and about Scotland Youth. And we have a lot of materials and resources on conspiracytour.wordpress.com, where people can go to find more information about the cases and about ways they can get involved. Again, that's conspiracytour.wordpress.com. And people can host fundraisers and send money to help out with legal defense needs, which are extraordinary. And we're also inviting people to come up to St. Paul, Minnesota, in October and November, and even into December for the RNCH trial, which we have on October 25th, and also to come out to Davenport, Iowa on September 13th, during that week for Stop the News trial. Packing the court is an extremely effective way for people to show solidarity and to show everybody else who's in the courtroom, such as the jury and the judge and the prosecutors, that there is an entire movement of people who are supporting these defendants and saying that we're not going to sit by as they try to chip away at our rights to organize and associate with one another.
We've been speaking with Jude Ortiz. He is an anarchist worker involved with efforts on behalf of the RNC8, who have been involved in political work regarding the 2008 Republican National Convention in the Twin Cities. And he is also an organizer and spokesperson on behalf of the Conspiracy Tour 2010, which has made a trip, a venue in Chicago, and is headed to other cities across the United States. Jude, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jude Ortiz, recorded on July 28, 2010. To learn more about the Conspiracy Tour, go online to conspiracytour.wordpress.com. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.